Welcome to the Big 60s Sort Out, brought to you by the Big Beatles Sort Out. We spent three series sorting the Beatles, and now we're turning our attention to the competition, the context, the bigger picture. Who were they up against? What music influenced them? And will we hear the shockwaves of the Beatles' epic success as we sort all the UK number ones from the 1960s by ranking them for music, lyrics and production? Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the 60s. Welcome to Series 4, Episode 4. I'm Gary Abbott, author, musician, podcaster, and please welcome my popular music history expert brother, Paul of the Abbotts.
Hello, hope everyone's all right and enjoying this, well, it's quite a grey January at the moment for us here. I hope by the time this episode comes out it has brightened up and everyone is feeling very forward-looking and excited for the new year ahead, having got the boring January bit out of the way.
Yes, if you're lucky, you might be enjoying a grey February by the time you're listening to this,
yeah.
Or about to be enjoying it, I'm not quite sure.
Do you know what, I don't even know what date this is coming out on, so there you go.
It's something like that. But yes, and we have been sorting out...
Oh, we're doing improv?
What?
Sorry.
Yes, and. Yes, and we're sorting out the 60s, and we've nearly sorted out 1960, haven't we? We're getting there. This is the last of the first year.
Yeah, episode. So only four episodes for 1960, so 17 songs that topped the charts. It won't be the same for every year by any means, and it'll be interesting to see how that carries along, on which year we've got lots and lots of one week, two week type stuff, and how many we've got, you know, long-lasting tunes. So, interesting.
It is interesting, yes. It was an aspect to this I hadn't really considered until we got cracking on it. Let's do the usual shabumbles, which is a new word. Please keep in touch with us on Twitter and Instagram at @big_sort or email us at bigbeatlesortout@gmail.com. And please like, subscribe and review our show if you would be so kind. And please consider having a little listen and dropping by mine and Paul's band camps, which are linked in the episode description. So, you know, go and have a little listen. That'd be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so shall we? There's no general Beatles chat, is there, Paul? So we should just get on with what was happening towards the end then of 1960 with the Beatles.
Yeah, indeed. So we left them in our last episode, essentially mid-August, and Apache was the last number one that we'd had, and that was number one until sort of the end of September. But what we've got here is basically a bunch of Beatles who've started becoming something of a proper band with a bit of a local following. You know, at least one or two really sort of what you'd call super fans, but they know them and they're sort of, you know, it's not like they've done anything superb or, but they've just got enough of a little vibe going on at the time, but they're not really getting anywhere anymore. You know, they've got this sort of end of term feeling about their prospects where some of them are suddenly like, what's next in life? And they're sort of like, well, you can back a stripper in your band. It's like, oh, okay. But suddenly Alan Williams turns around to them and basically says, I need another band to go to Hamburg because I've started doing this stuff out there. They want it to be a five-piece. So will you please get a drummer? So they think, who can we get? We've failed miserably before. Okay. Mona Best's son, Pete, we'll ring him up. We'll get him to come and audition. Mm-hmm. And basically, if they can get a drummer, they can essentially go to Hamburg, more or less like tomorrow type thing.
Right.
It's not literally tomorrow, but it's a very quick turnaround. So it's a big ask. They've got a promise of quite a lot of money, technically. You know, it's not a lot of money, but for them, it's a lot of money. And a lot of work. So they've got to convince their families, though. They've got to sort out their passports.
Yeah.
They've got, especially John, who doesn't get his passport sorted until literally the day they leave. And then, like, you've got Paul and John certainly have girlfriends. John's seeing Cynthia, Paul's with Dot, who had been pregnant with his child and had miscarried at about 3 months. They've got to sort out equipment, and they've got to get Pete to not only be in the band, but also to sort of be as much of the part of the look of the band as possible. You know, there's no particular uniform, but they've got enough of a look that's like, well, can you just wear a jacket that looks a bit like our jackets? Can you, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do a very quick timeline because, you know, everyone listening to this will more or less have an idea about what their Hamburg visits are like, and the first Hamburg visit particularly. So I'll do a quick run through of the timeline for this, just to show how nuts it is from here to the end of the year. So 13th of August, they audition Pete and he's accepted. You know, it's not like they were going to say no, though. So, 15th of August, which is a Monday, John's passport comes through first thing in the morning, and they get in the van outside the Jacaranda on Slater Street in Liverpool, and they drive down to Harwich, which is a ferry terminal, and then drive through to West Germany. They basically do 36 hours of solid travelling with a few stops off here and there where things happen. And they get there basically into Hamburg, and they meet their new boss, for want of a better word, who is this Bruno Koschmider, and eventually get a little bit of kip before they start work at the Indra Club the next day. So their heads must have already been like, where are we? What are we doing? So they've got an agreement for 2 months of work. They're going to be playing 4.5 hours every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, then 6 hours on a Saturday and 6 on a Sunday.
God, blimey.
It's nuts, isn't it? So it doesn't matter how good you would have been back in Liverpool or Britain, whatever. No one would have had that amount of material.
No.
It's nuts. But, so, you know, there's all the famous stuff like they have to sleep in the back of the cinema, the Bambi Kino, because no one's thought to actually sort out accommodation for them. I think they sort of assumed it'd be like, oh, well, we'll give you somewhere to stay and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what happens, except that it's Bruno Koschmider going, well, I'm paying you. Why don't you find your own stuff? And they're like, what? And he's like, all right, you can stay in the back of this flea pit cinema that we've got. So 17th of August, they do their first shows, covering quite a lot of chart hits, unsurprisingly, because, like I say, where do you get your material from? You know, you've got all your stuff, but you need to keep getting stuff to fill up this time slot. So they definitely cover Shaking All Over, which we did in the last episode.
Cool. And I'd love to hit that.
I know, it's amazing. It would be amazing, I'd imagine. But they also cover at least one of the songs that's going to be in this episode.
Right.
So they're playing from the 17th of August through the 2nd of October, which is their final show at the Indra Club, where basically they're just too loud. These rock bands he's put on has caused people to complain. And so they end at the Indra, and they get moved to the Kaiser Keller. And they also get an extended contract to take them to the end of the year.
Right.
And they're alternating slots with another Liverpool group, which is Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
With good old Bingo.
Good old Bingo. So Ringo's there. They've come from their Butlins sort of summer season. And then basically we have just so much stuff happening between there and the end of the year. Mm. Like on the 15th of October, they do a recording session, of which, of course, the recordings are lost. But it's a recording session with Wally Walters from the Hurricanes and Ringo and John, Paul and George. So there was a recording on the 15th of October 1960 with John, Paul, George and Ringo on it.
Wow.
Covers of probably Summertime Fever and September Song. But that recording is lost to history. But that's like, you know, that's a holy grail, that.
Yeah.
You know, that the Beatles before the Beatles were the Beatles, even though they were the Beatles. recursive Beatles.
What was Pete doing when Ringo was...
I just don't think that they were... You know, Pete and Stu had different things going on, you know. Because it's about the 20th of October, so a little after that, that Klaus Voormann first sees the Beatles. He brings along Astrid and Jürgen Vollmer. And then on the 1st of November, instead of their contract taking them through the end of the year, Bruno Koschmider basically says, I want you gone. Because basically they're annoying him massively, because they are annoying people, you know.
Right.
They're annoying kids. But also, he's not great. The situation's not great. They're not sort of being playing ball with him particularly. And so he basically says, oh, George is underage, which he is.
Yeah.
But he's just basically fed up of them. And they keep talking about wanting to go off to the Top 10 Club, which is a bit more classy.
Yeah.
And so circumstances happen. George is deported on the 21st. And on the 29th, when Paul and Peter leave in the Bambi Kino cinema, they get arrested after having set fire to the condom.
Yeah.
They get deported on the 30th. And then John leaves on the 7th of December. Stu stays behind because he's engaged to Astrid.
Hmm.
And this has all happened in next to no time, you know, a month and a half or something.
Wow, life moves fast, doesn't it?
It does, especially, yeah. And then
when you're a Beatle.
Yeah, when you're a Beatle in Hamburg for the first time. And then, of course, in December, we get to another point of like, does the band exist? Because they're not ringing each other up. No one's right, sort of, okay. You know, we've talked about this before, I think, but I think it's a really fascinating period whereby everyone's clearly exhausted and fed up and like baffled by what's happened.
Mm.
So Paul goes off to try and, well, he gets a job. You know, no one even knows John's back in the country. But eventually they all get back together and they go and do a few shows with Chas Newby on bass, who stands in with them for a bit. They play at the Casbah, they play the Grosvenor Ballroom, and they play the Litherland Town Hall on the 27th of December, which is that famous live from Hamburg, direct from Hamburg show, where everyone just suddenly is like, who are these guys? They are astonishing now.
Mm.
Because regardless of all the madness surrounding the shows, you know, they had the biggest rehearsal period any band's ever had
for a couple of months.
Yeah. And so they're a totally different band when they get back. And it's, I would, it's still my dream. When people say, which Beatles show would you go to in your time machine? It's always been Litherland Town Hall on the 27th of December.
Right.
Like literally just like an explosion happening.
With a mad bassist there, like just some.
With Chas bassist. Newby, who, funnily enough, left-handed bass player.
Oh, right. Okay.
And lovely guy, Chas Newby. He ended up playing, like in much, much later years, he became part of the Quarrymen. So he was a Beatle. Okay. Playing in the Quarrymen, sort of from the wrong direction, going back into the Quarrymen, having never been a Quarryman. I saw him in conversation a couple of years ago. He sadly died this year, May 2023. But yeah, it's nuts. But there's a brilliant quote from John, I think from about 1967. I'm just going to mention because it's also slightly relevant to something in this episode. He says, it was that evening that we really came out of our shell and let go. We stood there being cheered for the first time. This is when we began to think that we were good. Up to Hamburg, we thought we were okay, but not good enough. It was only back in Liverpool we realised the difference and saw what had happened to us while everyone else was playing Cliff Richard shit.
Yes, I can see the relevance.
Yeah. And so that is where we leave them at the end of the year. They are a different band to what they were at the start of the year by some margin.
And as they're bound to be, and talk about flying hours, I mean,
yeah,
4.5 hours a day.
That's in your short days.
On your short days.
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically playing a full. So rather than going to work full time 5 days a week, they're going to work nearly full time 6 days a week, but that work is just playing and playing and playing and playing. They're going to be so good that by the end of that, aren't they? Even if you did that for a week, you would be significantly better than a lot of people. Because gigs, you know, bands, you know, a gig every week, maybe, if you're in a quite a, you know,
I mean, it's
a casual thing.
Even like, so if I play a show now with Good Grief,
yeah,
and almost everyone else on the scene, you do a half hour, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's amazing that if you go off and do a little mini tour, even, like 4 or 5 days, and you're only playing half an hour a night, you get better.
Mm.
Because you're just doing it. It's not muscle memory. It's just being in that mode mentally as much as it is anything else.
Yeah.
And knowing that that's a thing that's what you're going to do.
Yeah. The more you do something, the better you are, generally. Yeah. It's practice. It's practice, practice, practice.
And also, you consider that the Beatles, with, you know, the best will in the world, even though they've been often backing, like, the, you know, Johnny Gentle on his Scotland tour or stuff like that, they were not a good band when they went out there. So their difference would have been so stark because of that experience. It wasn't like they were sort of pretty good, went to Hamburg and became really good. They were rubbish and came back really good. So that
did anyone else, Paul? Just to ask, I've got this thought percolating. So were there other bands that are on the same trajectory? The same could be said of, that they cut their teeth kind of...
I think it helped everyone. I think that the Hurricanes and Derry and the Seniors, everyone who was out there,
they were had all doing that experience. These long sets and
But not all of them were the Beatles, who were kids of that age with those sorts of relationships to each other and stuff like that, and the various things going on. So,
wow, there we go.
Good, innit?
Yeah. So let's see what John was on about, shall we? And look at the last four songs of that. Yeah, so I'm really interested now to know which one was in their set, considering I'm guessing it's not the one he wasn't happy with. Let's start. I don't think it can be this one. First up we have Tell Laura I Love Her, Ricky Vallance.
No one knows what happened that day, how his car overturned in flames. But as they pulled him from the twisted wreck, with his dying breath, they heard him say, tell Laura I love her, tell Laura I need her.
Tell Laura I love her, Paul.
I've took my phone's on airplane mode, so if you wait till afterwards, I'll text her.
Yeah.
And also, who's this Laura?
No, what? Yeah.
What?
What? No, nothing.
Right. Tell Laura I Love Her. I think this is a very well-known song, this.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a cover of an American song. I've got quite a lot to say about that fact. But yeah, Tell Laura I Love Her by, you said Ricky Vallance.
Ricky Vallance?
Ricky Vallance.
Oh,
I don't know
how
you say
it.
So the thing is, there's an American artist, Richie Valens, who I think gets sort of confused as well with this. But it's not. It's Ricky Vallance, who's a Welsh singer. So
okay.
This becomes number one on the 29th of September 1960. It spends 3 weeks at number one. It's on Columbia, so it's under the purview of Norrie Paramore. It's written by two writers, Jeff Barry and Ben Rally, but it's a cover of a song by a guy called Ray Peterson, an American singer. It got to number seven in America.
Right.
And so let me give you the background to this before we get stuck into the... Because I think this is really interesting before we get stuck into the music and production. This is a death disc. This is our second death disc. You know, people... Songs about dying, people dying songs. And stuff like that.
What was our first?
Running Bear.
Oh, Running Bear, yeah.
But this is more in the sort of sense of how people, when people think of death discs or teenage tragedy discs.
It's normally a car involved.
Yeah, it's more about abusing speed, not the drug.
Rather than two Native American tribes in a river.
Yeah.
It's normal, yeah.
Right, so Ricky Vallance was born, David Spencer, born in 1936, died in 2020. This is his only hit in the UK, and it's essentially it's the beginning of the end for him. It's a true one-hit wonder in the UK. He had his own sort of international success as well a little bit, and he sort of kept performing one way or another, but this is our first, and I don't think there's masses of them in the 60s that get to number one, but this is truly a one-hit wonder for Britain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, like I say, it's a number seven hit in America for Ray Peterson, but Ray Peterson's version doesn't come out in the UK because it's a death disc, and generally on the grounds of good taste, the BBC won't play that sort of stuff and record companies therefore won't release it. So
right.
I found all sorts of bizarre things about this. So it clearly what happened was Decca were looking to release the Ray Peterson version over here.
Mm.
And then so Sunday Mirror, 31st of July, 1960... There's a little paragraph with a heading, it's still bad taste, ... And it refers to the racing driver Stirling Moss. So Stirling Moss, very, very famous racing driver, was injured in practice at the 1960 Belgian Grand Prix. I mean, that's a race in which two people were actually killed, like horribly killed, because motor racing is terrifying. But this paragraph starts, now that Stirling Moss is better, so he didn't die, a death disc all about agonising death in a burning, overturned car is about to hit the market. The record, what a morbid idea, has already sold 500,000 copies in America. We delayed issuing it on the grounds of good taste when Stirling Moss crashed, a spokesman for Decca Records told me. The disc is titled Tell Laura I Love Her, the last words of a youngster before he dies. Tell Decca I don't love them much for putting out this sort of thing. And so that's from the a piece in the Sunday Mirror.
Right.
And then there's more art. So this is obviously like Decca saying, oh, well, we're holding off releasing it because of that crash, you know, Ray Peterson's version. And then in the Daily Mirror on the 4th of August, we have banned, but not by the BBC. You can tell Laura she's okay with the BBC. That the Laura, that is, of the controversial death disc entitled Tell Laura I Love Her. And then it's quite a big article about it. And the big Decca company who were going to issue the American hit disc by a singer named Ray Peterson changed their minds. They have withdrawn the record because of its phony sentiment, quote.
Right.
And it goes on, it's just this article about this disc. And then it goes into the fact that, yeah, they're not going to set they're not going to release Ray Peterson's version because they don't like his version, but they are going to release a version by our friend Ricky Valance,
because he sings it in a much more
reverential way,
acceptable way.
But there's also
maybe it was the addition. Maybe Ricky Valance is, what's it? How do you pronounce it?
I don't know.
Well, maybe it was the bom 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 bom, which just lightens the tone a little bit for the
maybe
the car crash material.
But also,
that's in the original.
Top Rank also released a version by John Layton, who is someone we'll come back to in future episodes. His version, I don't think, charted at all.
Right.
But obviously, Ricky Valance's did. Which is, it's insane that this was, even before the song came out.
Well, it sounds like it's got to number one because of all the
controversy
around.
Yeah.
That's a classic old.
And obviously, Norrie Paramore's basically gone, well, this is working perfectly for us.
Yeah.
Whatever we do, we're going to win here.
Yeah, because they're going to get a cut of whatever version goes out, aren't they? So.
At least Sterling Moss is okay. Never mind the other two sods who were actually killed in the race.
And everyone who's ever died in a car crash ever.
Well, yes, but, you know. In terms of contemporary news stories.
Yeah. Yeah, and all those singers.
Yeah.
Who keep on dying in crashes. But, yeah, I didn't realise it would be fall foul on the kind of the wrong side of the taste police at the time. Because
it's quite sort of symbolic of the period, really. Those sorts of death discs. That, you know, when you think of late 50s, early 60s, it's one of those things. Oh, yeah, that type of song.
It's like I called it kind of Teen Angel when I was describing it to someone, but that's because there's a song called that, which is the same kind of thing, isn't it? Someone, you know, teen lovers, one of them dies.
It's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, but not without any of the story.
Well, yeah, you know what I mean.
But yeah, okay, well, let's get on to it. I mean, I didn't know about it, and I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for it, Paul. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't shocked like the BBC style shocked of it. I wasn't going, I can't believe what my little ears are hearing. But we'll talk about that more in the lyrics. But it's hard to ignore the lyrics and the theme when you're listening to the music and there's a kind of a melancholic, lamenting theme.
Yeah.
And then the backing singers, like I said, are going, bum, 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 bum. Before the verse about the flaming car crash, it just the tone is weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I pulled him out of the flaming car. Bum 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 bum. It doesn't. It's hard to kind of go. Am I meant to be sad by this? I mean, it's quite a basic backing. It got a arpeggio guitar, a simple bass, some strumming and percussion. It's a soft but strong vocal by Ricky Valance, who is. Is it just me, but does he sound a bit like a proto-Morrissey now and again?
Well, he does...
I love her.
When he goes into the chorus, he definitely changes the tonal quality of his voice. A bit like Scylla does when she changes registers.
Yes,
in her voice.
She goes up a gear.
But yeah, he definitely does have a change in his sort of tonal quality, and I understand what you mean. And if it helps us to make fun of Morrissey, I'm all for it.
But it's a super simple type of verses, and the choruses aren't a big change. I mean, the verses are kind of like da 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 da. It's not. There's not much going on. It's all about getting those words over, isn't it? And the big change in the chorus. Well, not the big change. The big voice in the chorus. And it's quite straightforward because the backing vocals join in and it gets louder. The main vocal hook comes in, but it's not a big hook. The Tell Laura I Love Her line, I don't think. Although it has stuck in my head a little bit. I have actually found myself singing it a bit. But I presume it's that combo of the song story and the way it's nicely sang that gets it there. But from what you've just told me, actually, I think it's just the publicity that got it to the top. It is one of these teen tragedy 50s rock and roll things, but it's got a bit of a country feel in places as well. And it's sang kind of in a crooner style. It's not quite landing on either of any of those.
It's a funny one because apparently when they were recording it, the issue was like, well, I can't sing that sort of song, he says to the producers, Ricky Valance, and he says, well, sing it like it's a hymn. And he kind of doesn't, except for the fact that he is sort of, he goes a bit choir boy during the chorus, and then literally in the last verse when they're in the chapel in the song, the organ comes in and the backing vocals become a choir. So the original version is the original version is similar to this, but it's, if anything, it's slower, but it's a bit sort of looser, whereas this is quite strict, really.
Yeah, it doesn't really come together for me. I don't know why you'd really want to have a listen to this, to be honest. I've given it 34 for music.
It's interesting. So it was written, so the people who wrote it, obviously, like I say, it's an American hit. Jeff Barry was a very successful writer, producer, and when I say successful, this is a guy who wrote Leader of the Pack, another Death disc, Do Wah Diddy, Be My Baby, Sugar Sugar, River Deep, Mountain High. You know, these are some big songs he either wrote or co-wrote. And he was also a producer of a bunch of the hits of the Monkees as well.
Right.
And the guy who wrote the lyrics, he wrote lyrics for quite a lot of songs, not as many as famous as those ones I've just listed, but apparently wrote the lyrics for the Scooby-Doo Where Are You theme song.
Well, there you go.
For which
somebody had to.
Well, for which he wisely took a royalty rather than a one-off rate. Well, and you think about how much that's been played over the years.
It's still being played. I don't know if they still use the same thing, but there's always a new version of Scooby-Doo out there.
Yeah.
And there's quite often a return to that theme, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm sure the estate of Ben Reilly is probably doing very well out of it.
I just imagine someone had to sit there and going, Scooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? Brilliant. That's one line done.
Yeah.
That's great. Someone actually has to come up with it. You never think that something, I just think something like that exists.
That's true, just, yeah. And the fact that he was born canny enough to have seen Scooby-Doo and go, oh, I'm going to have a slice of that for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. Well, I mean, you know, he got a hit with it. It's just because I don't like it. He's obviously, he knew something about making the right kind of music because it worked, didn't it?
Yeah.
Production then. I mean, the vocal's very, very up in this song, very forward. It's obviously the feature. And it is a good voice to be exposed like that. Although it is quite loud in the choruses, and I've talked about the tonal kind of decision of having the bomb, 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 bomb backing in it, which, but generally the song sounds as I imagine they wanted it to sound, and I quite like the bass against the arpeggio and the soft strumming backing. I like the, like we talked about, the way that they play up to the theme in the third verse, and they bring in the kind of organ and the choir to kind of set it in a space. That's a nice touch. I can't really fault it too much, so I've given it 60 for production.
Oh, blimey, okay. It was arranged by a guy called Frank Barber, who was a composer from Manchester, who ends up doing quite a lot of film and television orchestration and arrangement work, including...
Can you tell me that he wrote the music to Scooby-Doo or something?
No, but he did do the orchestration for the music on Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Oh, blimey, that would be... I don't know if I've even seen Superman 4.
I know you might be a little bit too young. It used to be on TV when I've seen it a few times. It's dreadful. I might watch it tonight.
Yeah, it feels like it. You know, by 4 usually, it, at that time films were kind of. I mean, Jaws 4 is just something else.
Yeah, but, yeah. But let's not go down a Superman 4.
No, rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's a whole other thing. And there are other podcasts that have done that before. So you can go and listen to Smirsh Pod or something like that.
Fair enough. Right, let's move on to the lyrics then, which obviously is where this song lives.
Yeah.
And I mean, well, let's boil this down. Boy meets girl. Boy enters boxcar race to buy girl ring. Boy dies horribly. Girl cries at funeral. The end. There we go. That's the song, isn't it? That's what happens.
He wants to give her everything, and he lists everything: flowers, presents, and a wedding ring. That's everything, you know.
Well, I suppose presents could be anything.
Could be just anything. You know, stick a bow on anything. Are.
But I know there's.
Sorry, my favourite bit is in the actual scene where he's at the race. So he drove his car to the racing grounds. He was the youngest driver there, inexperienced. The crowd roared as they started the race. Round the track, they were over at a deadly pace. No one knows what happened that day.
How was car overturned in flames?
So, I mean, maybe people don't know specifically the engineering problem that happened, but I think probably everyone would have known what happened.
Yeah, his car crashed.
Yeah.
this is the thing why I say it sounds a bit country-ish as well, because it sounds a bit like...
Mean, country songs are all about misery.
Yeah.
Many of them are.
It has that kind of like, he rode into town and no one knew why. That kind of feel to it, you know. But it's not. It's he crashed his car and no one knew why. In fact, it's put me in mind of blooming Harrison and Faster Than a Bullet from a Gun.
Well, yeah.
It's got that kind of car. It's because it's a song about cars, isn't it? It's bloody... What? The problem is, it doesn't set up... You don't even know if... I mean, I presume, you know, he wants the $1,000 prize
to
buy the ring.
It'd be a very expensive ring for 1960, that.
Yeah. But there's other ways to do it. Not everybody... There's other ways to do it. I know there's a whole vein of these teen kind of angel death discs. It's a strange trend, isn't it?
It is.
But I find this one too... But I do find, like... I find like Teen Angel, that kind of song, I understand that because the tone of them is kind of just out and out cathartic sadness, isn't it? This just doesn't...
Yeah, like, no, I don't...
This doesn't get it.
It's a bit parochial.
And the lyrics don't seem to quite fit the length of the lines very well. It's not a brilliant set of lyrics. The meter's not brilliant. It feels a little bit like he's cramming it in.
I don't like
flowers,
that.
Presents, yeah. First of all.
He saw a sign for a stock car race. $1,000 prize, it read.
Yeah, that's yeah. When people start talking Yoda, you know they've had to bodge the lines together, don't you?
Yeah, a bit like that song in the Doctor Who Christmas special, where clearly they spent 5 minutes on the lyrics and thought that was okay.
Yeah,
but we're not going to go down that rabbit hole either.
I've actually got the same note here. Except my example was it feels like a poem set to music rather than lyrics, but not a great poem because it inverts clauses here and there, as in it says things like "with his dying breath they heard him say." So they can use the say rhyme kind of thing. It's just depressing, but not in a charming way. And I was going to say this is where you tell me it's all based on a true story, but it's...
I've got nothing more.
No, so 24 for lyrics, which gives it 39 overall.
That is not a song that the Beatles covered.
No, good. I can't imagine. Anyway, I wonder if it's this next one, Paul, which is Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely.
Only the lonely. No, I cry and cry for you. Maybe tomorrow a new romance. No more sorrow, but that's the chance you gotta take.
Only the Lonely, Paul.
Well, technically, the title is Only the Lonely, brackets, Know the Way I Feel, close brackets.
Oh, is it?
Yes, I believe that was just to avoid the fact that there was another song called Only the Lonely.
Oh.
So, first appearance of Roy Orbison on the charts. Roy was obviously 1936, died in 1988. It gets to number one on the 20th of October 1960, spends 2 weeks at number one. It was only a number two hit in America.
Mad.
It's produced by Fred Foster with Bill Porter Engineering. I think we've mentioned Bill Porter before. It's written by Roy Orbison and his friend Joe Melson. And over here it comes out on the London record label. And I will just mention, because before I forget, the B-side in the UK was a song called Here Comes That Song Again, which is this sort of, it's a more of a sort of traditional pop country song. But for some reason, the words of it, because the words are basically about this concept, Here Comes That Song Again, Here Comes That Song Again. Do you remember Here Comes Another One from Monty Python?
Here comes
another one. It's just like...
That's exactly what I was thinking as you said it. I was thinking...
It feels like that.
Is that one that Pine...
Here it comes again. So it isn't anything like that, but for some reason that came into my head. And I'm sure that would have made Roy Orbison laugh as well. So... But yeah, Only the Lonely. So this is a biggie, you know, when you think of Roy Orbison, really. If you want, by the way, I didn't find any links between Ricky Valance and the Beatles directly.
Okay.
Other than he's always used as an example of this is what it was like before the Beatles.
Right.
Roy, we know that there's tons of connections between the Beatles and Roy Orbison, not least the fact that in May and June of 1963, they did that famous tour together where Roy was headlining, but the Beatles were becoming so popular that they swapped them round in terms of who ends up, which I think Roy was probably okay with because he was getting paid three times what they were getting paid. It doesn't matter when he played, really.
Yeah.
So, but on that tour, they play in the Gaumont in Hanley, in Stoke.
Roy Orbison and the Beatles?
Yeah, which is now the Regent Theatre.
Oh, right, okay.
And Liverpool Empire on the 26th of May. But we'll be coming back to Roy Orbison, I think, two more times, maybe, something like that. So we'll mention some more about him and the Beatles. But the overview is he's another one of these singers from the south of America, Texan singer, rockabilly bands, and he comes through sort of Sam Phillips at Sun Records, as so many of the big names did.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really get anywhere on Sun Records, unlike Elvis, who really establishes himself on Sun Records. Roy Orbison doesn't quite do that, but he moves off to Monument Records and sort of reinvents himself with this new kind of Nashville sound that this song represents perfectly. So it's a sort of combination of him, the group of musicians he's got with him, the fact that he starts writing his own songs, and the studio at RCA Victor. And you basically end up with gold like this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very distinctive Roy Orbison sound, isn't it?
It's crafty. It's astonishing, really. These songs that you think you know well as well.
Yeah.
And then when you listen to them closely, it's like, this is weird song.
Are you peeking at my notes?
No, but I think it's just true, isn't it?
Because my first note is literally, you know when you think you know a song and then you do a podcast about songs and actually listen to it properly and realise you didn't really know it at all?
Yeah.
Because you think, oh yeah, only the lonely, da 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 dum da da. And then you listen and it's like, there's all sorts of mad stuff going on, which I shall talk about now unless you've got any more bits.
No, keep talking.
Yeah. So yeah, we all know those bits, but that's like less than half of it, isn't it? It doesn't kind of get across the actual unorthodoxy of this song. It has all sorts of interesting timing changes and a really strange structure, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite unlike most other songs, isn't it?
It's a very, very odd thing. And I wonder if that's partly a kind of sort of naivety of the two writers being quite young writers, you know, setting out on this journey, writing together for the first time, that they don't know what they're doing in terms of, like, they haven't gone, we better have a chorus here, we better have a verse here, then you better have this. They've just sort of gone, well, this is the song we want to write, and we'll write it, even if the vocal lands not quite where you'd expect it to land, and the backing vocals don't necessarily do what you'd expect them to do and stuff.
Yeah, because it's got things like a couple of bars of his 2/4 in it or something. There's bits where the timing kind of, there's a short bar and then it just, and it's like, actually you'd struggle just to pick up a guitar and play this.
Yeah.
Like you'd have to sit and, you know, read the transcript or figure it out or closely listen to it and go, oh, okay. It wouldn't be one that you'd just like, hey, what's it, keys it in, da da da. You'd have to kind of go, oh, what happens now?
And you'd also have to be able to sing as well as Roy Orbison.
It's just off the chart, you know. It kind of makes it kind of hard to latch onto and sing along with, but then it does have. But then you feel like you can because everyone knows only the lonely. You know, it's got those bits, but it's actually they're all a lattice work of actually really interesting stuff. But it has those pre-verse sections that are kind of just the backing. It starts the whole song with just like backing singers, kind of like, come on, Roy.
Yeah,
we've started. Like it does a whole verse worth, and he kind of like, I'll start now. And then he does that after what we might be the chorus. He does it again. It does a whole round of the backing vocals. And then, which is great because his vocal is so stunning.
Yeah, I mean, like literally the fact that they delay him coming in, you know, literally from the first note when he starts, the first phrase, it's like, that's a voice. Oh, so that's a voice.
They're either naively managed to craft something that sounds extremely mature and well worked out, or they just were very much, you know, mature ahead of their years to being able to work out those kind of things, those kind of little features. I mean, those choruses, the big hits and the strings punctuating around this build and his vocals.
Well, I don't think they are choruses. I don't think it's got a chorus. It hasn't got a chorus. It's got lots of links. No. It's got lots of links and two verses that are sort of Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, that the nearest you'll get to the chorus is where it's doing the big stops, yeah. And the da 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 da. It's the big build, isn't it? And yeah. But yeah, it doesn't really build and then hit, you know, the big sing along bit. So yeah, I don't know if it's a chorus, but the fact that the second time around he does it, he goes up that whole octave as well.
The falsetto bit, it's amazing.
It's very interesting. I mean, every time I hear Roy Orbison's voice, I think he's probably my favourite singer, like outside of the Beatles, you know.
Oh, right. That's an interesting thing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I always loved, because there was a reissue. I got on board with. I mean, I've not gone and bought any of his stuff. I just know whenever I get a chance to hear it, if I hear it, I'm always, he's brilliant. But I came on board with him when they reissued anything. You Got It. You Got It came out, you know.
Well, that was it. Did that when he sort of come back. Not, yeah, it was more or less a comeback in the 80s, yeah.
Was it a reissue?
No, it wasn't, no. It was a new thing, so.
New thing. I just love that. Yeah. I love that song. I absolutely love it. But you take him for people. I think he's taken for granted, and then when you actually sit and listen, you think, God, he was good.
Yeah, I mean, he had the problem of like he didn't do well to start. Then he had a sort of purple patch of a few sort of smash hits, and then he really dropped off again and really struggled in the late 60s and 70s, and could have sort of just petered out of it and been a bit of a nostalgia thing. But he was very lucky in that he got adopted by, you know, fans like George Harrison, like Tom Petty, like Jeff Lynne,
of course,
and brought back, but in a really good way, without it being too much of like, you know, playing on the past.
I've given this one 62 for music. I think it's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good band. Larry Parks on drums, Floyd Kramer on piano, Bob Moore on bass, Hank Garland and Harold Bradley on guitars, Joe Melson and the Anita Kerr singers on backing vocals, Anita Kerr doing this string arrangement as well, which is a very good arrangement. And the guy who he wrote it with, Joe Melson, was a mate, and they produced several hits, including this, as well as Crying and Running Scared, which were big hits. So, yeah.
Nice. Right, so going to production. Is it a vibraphone that's in there?
I think so, yeah.
It sounds great.
Just sort of hangs in the top of the frequency spectrum. Well, it happens at the
same. Yeah, it happens at the same time as the strings. So as they're kind of decaying, that's still wobbling out there and sustaining, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just resonates out like a wobbly echo of the strings, and the whole way the strings join in the first chorus bit, and that little riff they kind of do, like din din, they do a little very 60s sounding, little run, don't they? Which is kind of sits weirdly with the song, but. Kind of, it just shows the kind of fun they're having it, but it's a great bit of arrangement, and the knitting together of the backing vocals with Roy Orbison is brilliant. His voice is treated so well, and the echo was made for him, really, wasn't it? That's you see what everyone was trying to do when they were swamping everything in it. They were kind of do, but his voice just kind of lives inside it, so it's great. And then there's those huge hits on the strings. And is there something more than a floor tom in there, which is kind of helping to punctuate it? Is there a timp in there, maybe?
Possibly. I couldn't tell you. I think what's really important to remember here is I mentioned the name Bill Porter, and I think we've talked about him before, and we'll talk about him again. Mm. You know, he doesn't get the credit necessarily because he's not a producer, he's an engineer, but he's a guy who sort of like, do you know what? We're going to make his voice, the main feature. Then everything sort of trickles down from there, which is not necessarily how you engineer a session normally and prepare a mix. You tend to do all your backing and then put your voice on top of it and sort of carve the notches out that you need to do that to get it to all sit together. So he makes Orbison's voice the feature. And that's why the band is actually quite muted in some respects. It's all pulled back. But then that also gives it space for the strings and the vibes to come in. And basically he invents this sound, which is the Orbison sound, and sort of changes a bit of the Nashville production approach for Nashville sort of pop rock sound. And it's clearly the winning formula. Everything's come together, like you say, either through planning or naivety, probably a bit of both.
But it was a little bit of magic.
Yeah, it's great engineering.
I've given it 70 for production.
Mm.
So then, on to the lyrics. I mean, when you said it wasn't the first song to be called Only the Lonely, I thought, oh, because Only the Lonely is a great little little line.
It looks great. Even written down, it looks great because of the repeated letters in it.
Yeah, it's an I rhyme and a actual rhyme. And it's a shame that he can't claim to have coined it if there was another one already out there. But it, you know, he obviously owned it if he didn't coin it. It pretty much fill in the blanks from there on in, though, isn't it?
Yes.
It's breaking hearts, sorrow, crying. It's all the usual. So it's a title stretched out to a song. But I much prefer this to Flaming Car Wrecks. So, you know, I like the repeated, there goes my baby, there goes my heart. They've gone forever, so far apart. That's good. It's all good, but it's
pretty
simple. Slight.
Yeah. I mean, like the falsetto bit at the end where it sort of splits a concept across. It's like, but that's the chance. And then the falsetto bit is you got to take, which is doesn't really work in terms of continuity of the rhyme. But I mean, the point is the falsetto voice performance is more important than the words are by tenfold. Yeah. So
I've still given it 49 for lyrics because I think it's they're the right lyrics for this song. Can't imagine anything else. You don't want to detract from anything else going on, do you? So that gives it 60 overall.
Hmm.
Is this the one they played? I doubt it.
I don't think so, only because, like you say, it's quite difficult.
Difficult.
I know that they were fans. The Beatles were fans, and they were fans at the time. I imagine they would have tried to play this, but I can't imagine they'd have got away with it.
No, and yeah, that's what I would say when I said it wouldn't be the kind of one you just pick up a guitar and go like, oh, yeah, figure it out. You might do something, but it wouldn't be sound
although
brilliant.
Although that said, the Beatles did work up some quite nifty arrangements of things, but perhaps not in 1960.
Yeah, maybe not. Okay then, so we go on to the next one?
Yeah, we better add.
Next, it's Elvis Presley with It's Now or Never.
When I first saw you, with your smile so tender, my heart was captured, my soul surrendered. I spent a lifetime waiting for the right time. Now that you're near, the time is here at last. It's now or never.
It's now or never, Paul.
Oh, let's go. Well,
let's do it.
Let's do it with the biggest selling single of the year. Okay, so this is the big one.
How many weeks?
8 weeks at number one, this one.
8 weeks.
So this is the big block that takes us essentially through to the end of the year.
Yeah.
It gets to number one on the 3rd of November 1960. Interestingly, it was released on the 5th of July in America. And the delay is because there is issues to do with the copyright in Europe over who wrote this, which I'll talk about in a second.
Hmm.
But this is a ludicrously famous song for a bunch of different reasons, but mainly because it's Elvis doing It's Now or Never. Produced by Steve Sholes with Chet Atkins and Bill Porter again.
No way he is.
Written by... Well, I'll get to that. You know what? I'll get to that separately.
Mm.
It's out on RCA. It's obviously number one in America as well. I mean, we're going to be talking about Elvis a lot in the next few episodes, so I'm not going to go massively into his story.
Who this Elvis chap
Who's
is?
Who's this Elvis? I watched the recent biopic today.
Oh, right. Where's that? Is that
the Baz Luhrmann one? So I watched that. Two hours, 40 minutes of Baz Luhrmann's Elvis.
Is it good?
I have a strange relationship with biopics, them being the subject of my master's dissertation and stuff like that. And this does everything a biopic does, really, which doesn't make it great. Good performance by Austin Butler as Elvis, but I don't think they necessarily told any story. And for some reason, Colonel Tom Parker talks like this, my boy, in a way that he definitely didn't, my boy.
Okay.
So maybe I'll do the rest of this like this. No, I won't. But yeah, let's just assume that most people know the broad brushstrokes of Elvis's life. Obviously, born in 1935, dies in 1977, only 42 years old. But at this period, he's been in the military. So he's had his solid sort of gold start with Sun Records and then moving off to RCA. But he ends up getting drafted, as was going to happen. And despite all the concessions they made for him to help him finish off films and sort of, they did tons of stuff to sort of accommodate him, really.
Yeah.
He gets his military induction is on the 24th of March, 1958. And then basically it goes through to the 5th of March, 1960. And he's based in Germany.
Right.
When he's flying home is where he stops in Prestwick in Scotland to refuel the plane. And that's the only time he sets foot on British soil in his entire life.
Right.
But like I say, we've got lots more Elvis to come. He's had about 20 top 10 hits in the UK by this point, including 4 number ones. He is a, you know, someone we're expecting good things from, but we've had that firebreak of him being in the army.
Yes.
This is a different Elvis to the one of the 50s now.
And, right.
And this is, I think, really representative of what's going to happen, this song.
Elvis sat there musing away for 2 years in army barracks in Germany, thinking, I really want to rework traditional Italian songs into big overblown ballads. That's the new direction for me.
That's what he would have said.
That's what he said. Well, you know when you think you know a song,
of course, my boy,
and then you do a podcast about songs and actually listen to it properly and realise you didn't really know it at all.
Yeah.
Well, not that actually. This was exactly what I thought it was.
Yeah.
This is like, oh yeah, yeah. This is Now or Never by Elvis. This is, I mean, pretty much all I made me think of listening back to it was, damn the person who repurposed this for the Cornetto ads, because that is all I can hear.
Yeah. So do you want to explain that for impossible. Our overseas listeners who might not know? I don't know if the advert played anywhere except the UK.
I don't know. I would you know that kind of thing? I suppose you'd have to research it, wouldn't you? So yeah, if that doesn't mean anything, there is a brand of ice cream, frozen ice cream, obviously, called a Cornetto.
Yes.
Everyone knows what Cornetto is because that's talked about openly. And
talked about openly, you make it sound like people openly. Are concealing their Cornetto knowledge.
I meant to say internationally there. Because of the things like the Cornetto trilogy, people know what that means, don't
Maybe,
they?
Maybe, I don't know.
But there's an ice cream brand called Cornetto, and there was a series of adverts, at least in the 80s, where the theme was to the tune of Now or Never, just one Cornetto.
And then can you remember the rest of the words?
Give it to me, delicious ice cream from Italy. That was it.
Or more likely a warehouse somewhere up. Yeah, somewhere
probably
near
from
London.
Scunthorpe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone, I mean, without
exception. It was a huge hit marketing campaign.
Yeah. Everybody in the UK who was alive at the time, and probably some who weren't, will only hear that song when they hear this. That's all you'll hear, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, let me tell you what the song was originally. I mean, so obviously, like I say, it's a smash hit for Elvis, but it was O Sole Mio, okay? It's a Neapolitan language song. It's a dialect of Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Written in 1898. It basically means my sunshine, oh my sunshine, O Sole Mio. Written by Eduardo de Capua, who, 1865 to 1917, although he probably actually just bought it from someone else.
Right.
A guy called Alfredo Masucci, who only died in 1972, and original lyrics by Giovanni Capuro. It was recorded by the very famous tenor Caruso in 1916, which is the version Elvis knew.
Mm.
And then later on, a singer called Tony Martin, who was a sort of tenor crooner, did an English language version called There's No Tomorrow, which Elvis hears and is like, well, I'll do a version. But
Tony Martin had a bit of a resurgence, didn't he?
Don't know. Did he? I only know him from being the sort of male, handsome, romantic lead in the Marx Brothers film, The Big Store.
Oh. I might be getting him mixed up with someone else.
Tim Martin, the head of Wetherspoons.
No.
Don't worry about it. Don't go down the Tony Martin hole.
Okay. Oh, dear. No, definitely not.
But basically, Elvis is like, well, we could do with a different lyric. And other people are like, yes, because for copyright, that's good, because it gives us some copyright ownership on it.
Yeah. At least we did something towards it other than just...
Except that when it gets to the UK, we have different copyright terms and stuff like that. So they had to work out a copyright and royalties arrangement, which is why the composers are listed as Wally Gold and Aaron Schroeder, who wrote the English language lyrics for It's Now or Never, but it is still credited in the UK alongside Eduardo Di Capua, who was the guy who wrote it or claimed to have written it, but actually bought it from Alfredo Masucci, of which there was a lawsuit later on in the 70s from his family.
Okay.
So, there's all sorts going on with that. But the point is, Elvis heard a couple of versions of it, said, I'll do my own version. Ends up doing the definitive version until the Cornetto advert.
Which is now the definitive version.
Yeah, to people of our age. Which I know, and honestly, this is not us being glib. It was such a successful advertising campaign.
Anyone in the UK, if you come to the UK and you've never been before, or even if you have been before but you don't live here and you come to the UK, go into any room of British people and sing
Oh, Sole Mio.
One Cornetto. Even just say just one Cornetto and people will turn to you and say, give it to me. It's a guaranteed thing.
Yeah, okay. But let's put it behind us now.
Let's get
on with this.
The other thing that doesn't help me with this is that it also sounds like all bossa nova single finger autoplay settings on keyboards.
Yeah, it is.
So you've got the fast double picking mandolin sound, which is obviously nice.
So I presume that's an acoustic guitar simulating it. Scotty Moore or someone like that.
And the shuffling percussion and the plinky piano, etc. And of course, an extremely memorable melody, which is why Elvis did it. He had his ear on something that... Am I right in seeing... This is one of his biggest selling single? Is actually Elvis's biggest selling single?
Okay. It is.
Oh
yeah.
It is. My goodness.
I mean, it's the biggest seller of the year, and it's Elvis's biggest selling single of all time. And it's biggest selling single of all time ever.
What?
In terms of things that sold on physical media.
What's going on with the existence? What is that about?
It's mad, isn't it?
I mean,
it's huge, but you've got to remember, he's been away from the scene. He was massive. He was taken out of the scene for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And this is essentially his return to show business. And so,
I mean, I can't imagine not having heard the Cornetto advert and then hearing this. And maybe that would just be like, whoa, that's a cool song. Whoa, that's blown my mind. Maybe that it would have turned me into a weird Californian Dylan. I don't know. But, yeah.
Mad, innit?
Yeah, but I mean, one thing I can say, obviously, it's nice to hear Elvis singing, and he can sing, and he opens up his big crooner voice when he gets to the choruses. You know, he really does let it go there. But you know what? I prefer Roy Orbison's voice.
Yeah, well, so do I, but there you go.
But, though they are similar in the way that Elvis is singing this in a, I'm going to do my Roy Orbison voice, not that he would be thinking that, but, you know, he opens up. But he doesn't quite ever hit that tone that I think Roy can do in the softer bits, you know. But he really hammers it in the chorus. It's really hard to rate a song like this. It's always been there. I don't think I would have gone and bought it myself, even without the Cornetto. And I think I would have got bored of it if it was on the radio for 8 weeks. I would have been like, okay, enough now. It's just an earworm, basically. It's a very successful earworm.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've given it 57 for music.
It's interesting, really. I mean, he's got a great band with him there, and he's got some, you know, he's got the Jordanaires there doing the backup vocals and stuff like that. And it's a nice arrangement in terms of what they do. But like you say, it is very sort of, oh yeah, there's that, you know, I don't think it's quite a bossa nova, more like a begin or something like that. But
I don't know what that is.
Close. And it's got, yeah, I don't know. It's a funny one. It is mad that this is as big a song as it is.
Yeah, no, maybe, that's the strange
and
thing.
This is what I'd be interested to what our listeners feel about this, because it's hard, as it is with the Beatles, it's hard to judge someone like Elvis when there's so much of his reputation comes, you just grow up with it.
Yeah.
And then something like this, you know, when you think of Elvis, you've got sort of, your brain can go to all sorts of different places. And I don't think people's brain necessarily goes to this, but maybe it does. I'd be really interested to know what people think about this.
I didn't, when it came up, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, he did that, didn't he? It's not the one that I thought of. But hey, let's go on to production. Again, hard to judge when it sounds like the a keyboard backing track. I like the backing vocals thickness at the start, which offsets Elvis's lead nicely, which they need to do because when he opens up for his big now or never line, it kind of pushes the dynamic range, and they handle that very well because he's really opening up. Yeah, I like the general plinky plonky sounds of the pianos and the guitars. I don't have much to say about the production. It just sounds like it's Now or Never by Elvis, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting because Elvis is, of course, one of these people, like the Beatles, has been very well covered, so we can find out loads of information about the production of this. And it's also interesting that the mix you'll hear most often is the stereo version.
Right.
Because it's quite a wide mix. It's like the bass and piano are all off at one side, and I'm always a big fan of like bass and piano doubling. And the backing vocals are all off in your other ear.
Yes, yeah.
As well, with Elvis in the middle. So Bill Porter, again, who's our hero of this episode, they do a load of recording during the April the 3rd and 4th, 1960. You know, they record 12 songs, two of which become number ones. So Bill Porter basically says, Elvis was having some trouble singing the ending notes because he basically sang his songs in the baritone range, and then the end note of the song was in the tenor range. So they do about 8 takes of it, and then he says, he suggests to Elvis, can we just do the ending again? I can splice it on without going all the way through the song again, you know, cut the tape together.
Yeah.
And he says, Bill, I'm going to do it all the way through or I'm not going to do it at all. So he did it again, and of course he got the way he wanted it, except that apparently the notes say it's take 4 with the ending of take 2 stuck on. So,
right. So he did it anyway.
Yeah.
No, all good. No, all good, Elvis. All good, mate.
See, yeah, like, yeah. No, don't worry about it. Move on.
What are those scissors? Yeah. What are you doing with them scissors?
Yeah. But they...
I've never tried an Elvis impression before. That wasn't...
And you start with stationary-based material.
That wasn't the line to try it with. Yeah. Oh, what are you doing? I can't do it.
There are no scissors here, my boy. But yeah, he also mentions that Floyd Kramer, who's the piano player whose name crops up loads of times, overdubs castanets, although I can't hear castanets on it.
There's a lot of kind of... It's
there's
quite clave.
There's claves, like ding, ding, ding type, you know, wooden... Castanets are Spanish anyway, not Italian. But yeah, that's interesting. So it was, these productions. It's like 12 songs in 2 days and they managed to get 2 huge number ones out of them.
I've given it 64 for production because it obviously sounds really good. It just sounds like what it is. And there's nothing kind of letting it down anywhere. So yeah, it's good. Lyrics then?
Go on.
So the lyrics are, just one cornetto, give it to me. Delicious ice cream of Italy, creamy vanilla and chocolate dream, give me cornetto from Walls Ice Cream. Yeah. I forgot the second part of that, actually.
Yeah.
No. It's now or never, come hold me tight, kiss me my darling, be mine tonight. Tomorrow will be too late, it's now or never, my love won't wait. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to do it all. I mean, there's some good romance in here. My heart captured, soul surrendered. It's quite evocative language there, isn't it? It's
like all a willow we would... 25 minutes of time they spent writing these lyrics.
Yeah. Like a willow we would cry an ocean. I don't know why willows. I mean, weeping willows. Yeah, I suppose. There we go. Your lips excite me, arms invite me. It's now or never, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, he ain't half laying it on thick. You know, imagine Elvis... just singing this to you, and you're like, all right, then.
Hmm.
It's overblown romantic nonsense, but of course it has to be. I mean, he's singing it to a traditional Italian kind of love song, and he's got to do something mushy and overblown. So I've given it 42 for lyrics.
I mean, it's not a bad 25 minutes work for Wally Gold and Aaron Schroeder, is it, really, to come up with that and it become one of the biggest singles of all time?
It's madness. So it gets 54 overall, Paul, 54.
Okay, the B-side in England, at least, or the UK, rather, is a song called Make Me Know It, because the song that was on its B-side in America was released as a single itself over here to sort of bridge the gap where they're dealing with the copyright issue in the background. Yeah, but Make Me Know It is much more upbeat sort of song. I quite like it, actually. But it's got that it starts with a piano part that sounds exactly like the song Karma Sutra by the Bonzo Dog Band. That's interesting. Beatles link
to Elvis?
Well, to this song.
Okay, to this song. Is this the one they tried?
They did this in Hamburg.
Yeah.
This is a Paul song in Hamburg. So one of their big standout sort of spotlight moments was this. And then in 1987, Paul recorded a version of it for his album that was going out in Russia. But it didn't get released until 1990 on an all-star tribute to Elvis that was called The Last Temptation of Elvis.
Wow.
Would you want to hear my tribute to Elvis?
Go on then.
Thanks, Elvis.
Right.
That's an Emo Phillips joke.
Oh, okay.
It's much better when he's doing it.
Right. Okay, so we go on to the last one then?
Yeah.
We have, finally, Cliff Richard and the Shadows. I Love You.
Your love means more to me than all the fishes swimming in the sea. And like those fishes, my heart begins to swim because I love you, I want you for my own. I need you near to me more than anyone could ever know.
I love you, Paul.
If you loved me, Gary, you wouldn't make me listen to this song.
Well, sorry.
Right, let's get on with it. Right, Cliff Richard and the Shadows. The song is called I Love You.
Just I Love You.
Yeah, it's about as simple a title as you can get.
Yeah.
Becomes number one on the 29th of December 1960. So it's essentially, as the charts lie, this is the Christmas number one. No, that can't be right. Christmas is before then. People have this list as the Christmas number one, but it must be Elvis. But it's two weeks at number one. Producer Norrie Paramore. Composer Bruce Welch of The Shadows. And the B-side is a song called D in Love, which is a sort of rockabilly thing, which is a bit more like early Cliff. Which contains the line. So a lot of D in Love is about, like, you need to do more homework by kissing and cuddling me type thing, because you're getting a D in Love.
Oh, I see.
You know, okay. You've got like a B in biology, but it also contains the line, you're an encyclopedia, which is brilliant and dreadful.
But that's not the song we're listening to.
No, right. It comes out on Columbia. So basically, between Please Don't Tease, which was his last number one, he puts out a song called Nine Times Out of he puts out a song called Nine Times Out of Ten, which only gets to number three.
Yeah.
Which was apparently voted for by a panel of teenagers. So they played a bunch of his unreleased stuff and they went, yeah, put that one out. And it got to number three. Which is a bit of a dull song, Nine Times Out of Ten. It's a bit more rocky, but
it's a bit of a dull song, and it didn't, and the other ones that we've listened to.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But I think what's interesting with Cliff here is, right, so like I say, this comes to number one at the end of the year. Cliff only turns 20 years old in October of 1960. He's 5 days younger than John Lennon.
Wow.
But he's already had a string of hits.
Yeah.
This is the period where he's basically saying, oh, what's it going to be like not being a teenager anymore, Cliff? And he's going, oh, I'd love to be a teenager forever. I'd love to be Peter Pan. And basically, that's the nicknames stuck with him over the years, hasn't it? The Peter Pan of pop. But what I will say is we won't be hearing anything more from Cliff in 1961. This is our last one for a year or so. We will be hearing more from The Shadows.
Right, okay.
So let's deal with I Love You, the title that clearly Bruce Welch thought, I can probably get away with that.
Yeah. Before we do, actually, we need to deal with the enmity of ages, which is Elvis versus Cliff.
Okay, yeah.
So I thought we'd get a view from an eyewitness.
An eyewitness?
Or an ear witness. So I asked Mum.
All right.
Who she favoured at the time.
At the time.
So, what would your guess be?
Right. Well, I don't know. I think she'd probably look like Cliff more.
Okay, so we find out. So listen. So talking about Elvis, the last person in this episode, which we've talked about before, was Cliff Richard and the Shadows.
Yeah.
Who, I Love You, that song. Mm-hmm. And so I think Paul said he was interested as to what your view on Cliff was at the time.
I was never a Cliff Richard fan.
No.
I think at school we separated into the Cliff and Elvis groups.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's like so the Cliff v Elvis was the big UK rivalry.
Yeah.
As in not he wasn't from the UK, but in the charts you'd go and that would make sense seeing as they've had one like a number one within you know.
Yeah. No, I mean Elvis was always my favourite.
Mm.
Cliff and the Shadows.
It's not as exciting, is he, as Elvis? He's...
He just hadn't got whatever it was that Elvis had got.
Yeah.
He didn't have the same sort of appeal to me. So, but it did seem to split a bit like the Beatles and the Stones.
Yeah.
You know, it was that. If you liked one, you know, you didn't like the other.
Right. So, and you were in the Elvis camp.
And I was in the Elvis
camp. Out of the Cliff and Elvis
scenario. So,
Well, I can understand that. Because his songs are boring. it was Elvis. You got it wrong. But yeah,
sorry,
she was. Actually, said that like you know, it was a bit of, it was a kind of the a rivalry that probably only one half of that rivalry knew it was a rivalry. Like it was a rivalry within kids in the UK. Oh, do you like Elvis or do you like Cliff? But yeah, I don't think Elvis would have been aware.
Yeah, he wouldn't have cared.
Of that. But,
don't tell him anything about Cliff Richard, my boy.
I'm going to have to watch this biopic to know where you're getting that from, really. So there we go. So, Elvis.
Oh, interesting.
Elvis out of the Cliff. And listening to this, you can understand why, can't you? I mean, I had a kind of a strange experience with this one. This nearly did really, really well in our charts. Because I accidentally listened to a version on Spotify, which is the first one that came up when I searched for it. So I thought that was it. Where someone or other, and it's an official one, so I presume it was done later down the line, has added a really prog string intro and backing vocal outro and then carried the strings on throughout the song and remixed it. And it all blends really nicely. And it was like, wow, this is really interesting. It's like bubblegum.
Well, you mentioned something like this to me and you said, I have the version with the strings. And I've been looking on Apple Music. I cannot find a version other than the version
I'll send you the Spotify.
You must do. Now, what I do know is Cliff has recently put out an album with strings on it, like some of his classics with strings on, as has happened to Roy Orbison and Elvis Presley as well. You know, it's a good way to utilise your back catalogue.
Yeah.
By sticking out old stuff, but sticking a Philharmonic Orchestra on it as well for some reason. But I couldn't find a version of this, and it seems like a very odd one that you'd to put.
Honestly, it works a bit like some of the Moody Blues' kind of proggy stuff, where you kind of get these kind of cool intros. I'm thinking about the one that...
Question?
Yeah, you know, it comes out of a weird kind of linky beginning bit, and then you get quite a...
But then it goes, your love means more to me.
But it's weird because it ends up being a bit like Dennis Potter-esque. It makes it kind of a weird wash of kind of like, because the strings that ring it in is a big, long, melancholy string intro. And then this song emerges out of it really nicely mixed and with really close harmonies. And it's from an album called Reunited. I Love You, Cliff Richard and the Shadows, from an album called Reunited.
Oh, right, okay.
So, goodness knows if that... Maybe they redid it.
Why couldn't I find that then? I don't know.
From 2009, they must have done some weird re-recording of it. It's a good version. Much better when you take all that stuff away. And all these gushing notes about, I wasn't expecting that big string intro. I was prepped for a boppy, wet pop song, which does actually end up being what it is.
Yeah,
but it brought a new dimension to it, and it just kind of, if anything, highlighted to me how fickle I am for a good bit of production. But without that, it's just a bubblegum pop song, isn't it? With that softness again, that kind of cliff and the shadows kind of like, oh, don't turn it up too much. Oh,
well, do you know what's interesting? I found in Disc magazine from November 19th, 1960, there's a little mini preview of songs coming out, and there's, and it says Cliff Richard, and it lists as the A side the what is actually the B side, D in Love. It says, Cliff comes out a-rocking again as he sings about his girl, who is clever in school but a dunce when it comes to romancing. D in Love should see him scoring an A in the top 10 once more. The young star snaps it over effortlessly to another sure backing by the twangy Shadows. But it's not that big. That's the B-side.
Mm.
And then it says, Bruce Welch of the Shadows wrote, I Love You. It is a song which makes it difficult to tell which will be the main attraction of the coupling. I prefer this gentle, lilting ballad, which Cliff sings warmly and with some tenderness. So maybe, I don't know whether they were told, these are the two sides, one of them will be the hit,
and just
let it happen. But it sounds like they were initially promoting D in Love, but...
Which I prefer, this one's better than Please Don't Tease. It's daft in that it's... I don't mind the kind of niceness of this one a bit, because it is kind of more bubblegummy pop, you know, it's kind of like... Yeah, it's not, rather than just being a bit wet in all departments, it's at least got a bit of a melody in it. I've given it 43 for music.
It's a funny one. This is another one where it feels a bit mechanistic to me because it is so simple. And part of me says, well, that's the Shadows' appeal as a backing band, in that if you're an aspiring guitarist or drummer or bassist or whatever, you hear the Shadows, they're like, they sound quite cool, but not unlearnable. You know what I mean?
Accessible.
So the guitar solo in this is you know, that's not difficult to work out for anyone really. But it does also feel a bit like there's a studio and the Shadows are all just like in shadow, not moving. And they go, ready, make a new single, Cliff? And Cliff says, yeah. And they press a button and the Shadows go, and then they say, finished. And then they press another button and the Shadows go,
back into switch them on and off.
Yeah, just switch them on and off.
And they push them
and that's a new
cupboard.
Single. which is not fair because they're so much better than that.
You know, it feels a little bit to me on the ones behind Cliff so far that they're just dialing it in.
Doing a job of work, basically.
Just like, playing. Because it feels like it's a choice that they've gotten. And we moved a bit onto production here. You know, it feels like the choice is to say, don't do anything too much. Like if one of them just went, they'd all go, no, stop it. Just play the chords softly. Just go and buff your plectrums so they're not too sharp.
Buff your plectrums. Where's Hank? Oh, he's off in the corner buffing his plectrum.
Buffing his plectrum. Yeah. So it all feels like the edges have been so sanded down that it's just smooth. But not in a smooth way. I don't know what I'm saying. I've given it 49 for production. It's a fine pop song.
It's just drenched in reverb as those things from that period are. There is actually the only other alternative version I've heard of this is what they call the undubbed version, take 10, on an album called The Early Years. But the only dubbing is a vocal harmony at the end of the lines on the sort of the tag lines of each verse. But it's an interesting listen enough.
But then that might be something to do. So go and listen to the one I told you about, because that one, I scored it really high for production. It was in danger of becoming within the top 10, this song, the version I heard, because the production was so good with the mixture. It made a really interesting lateral way of doing it.
Your voice when you're getting that excited.
Yeah, but without that, it's just kind of like back to just being what it is. Right. So onto the lyrics then. I mean... something about these lyrics puts me slightly in mind of a harvest festival hymn in a school hall in the 80s.
It's because
the song as well, with it sounding quite childlike, you know, childish, you know, all the your love means more to me than all the apples hanging on a tree, and like those apples our love will grow because Jesus. And then there's fishes swimming in the sea, and like those fishes my heart begins to swim. Ugh. It's all very simplistic, but they do the job.
But the hook line is, I love you. It's wet.
It is wet.
Even though almost every other song that's around is essentially saying that. And here he's just literally saying it. I don't know. I mean, Bruce Welch must have been laughing his head off because he ended up getting the A side of the single or the hit. Mm. And he's got the songwriter copyright on it and he performs on it. I bet that didn't hurt his bank account.
No, no. I've given it 42 for lyrics. It gets 45 altogether.
I like, everyone knows one and one makes two. I'm the one and the other one's you.
But I quite like
that's
that.
Quite a good line, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I don't think they're terrible at lyrics. I think the title's not particularly good. But I think that for a pop song, like a simple pop song, it's simple lyrics. It's just what it is. It's just better with the big prog strings and weird backing and the
still
and
just can't believe it.
They don't. It's very strange. You'll have to have a listen. But no, that's not the version we're ranking. And that's that done. That's this week
that's
done for.
1960 taken care of.
So that gave us that first 17 songs. I'm just going to do them all in the chart because I can rattle through 17 pretty quickly. I'll probably stop doing that when we get to 20, I think. So shall I go through everything from we've done down to number one?
Yeah, do it, pop pickers.
Here we go. At number 17, Anthony Newley, Do You Mind? At number 16, Anthony Newley, Why? At number 15, What Do You Want to Make Those Eyes at Me For? Emile Ford and the Checkmates. Number 14, Lonnie Donegan, My Old Man's a Dustman. Number 13, Adam Faith, Poor Me. At number 12, Please Don't Tease, Cliff Richard and the Shadows. At number 11, Tell Laura I Love Her. At number 10, Johnny Preston and Running Bear. At number 9, I Love You, Cliff Richard and the Shadows.
Weird.
At number 8, Good Timing, Jimmy Jones.
Should be much higher.
At number 7, Three Steps to Heaven, Eddie Cochran. At number 6, Michael Holiday and Starry Eyed. At number 5, It's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. At number 4, The Everly Brothers, Kathy's Clown. At number 3, Roy Orbison and Only the Lonely. And at number 2, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, Shaking All Over. And at number 1, still, Apache, The Shadows.
Oh, interesting.
It is interesting. I don't know how Cliff got to number 9.
It's your numbers, you fool.
I don't know what's happened there. I think he's confused me by redoing his own song. It lingered some point. I did produce some of them, but maybe not enough. Who cares? We listened to it and that's fine. Well, there we go. 1960 done.
Yeah.
Next week, we'll be back with a bump. I mean, this is already long. We're going to have to try and do it
Five songs in next week's episode.
Five songs to start us off on 1961, and then there'll be four song episodes for however many there are of that. So join us next week for 1961. Oh, thank you very much, Staplers.
Have a wonderful time, my boy, but don't.